I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Our guest, Barbara Bradley Haggerty, says that middle age has gotten a bad rap, often associated with decline and loss and usually associated with the word crisis. She writes in her new book, Life Reimagined, that there's almost no evidence of midlife crises are a common experience. Yes, people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s complain about aches and pains. They see their bodies don't do what they used to do. They can feel as if their memory is not as sharp as it used to be. And many experience the death of a parent or parents and loved ones at this time. So it can be a wistful, contemplative period of life, but also a time of excitement, pleasure, growth, and renewal. She talked to a lot of researchers about what they're learning about middle age, and one of the consistent findings, do new and challenging things, take risks. The brain likes novelty. Barbara Bradley Haggerty joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. For 19 years, she was a reporter for NPR, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. This book, yes, is about middle age. It's also about you. Yes. And there was a certain period in your life. In fact, you were working at NPR as a reporter, had a bit of a medical scare. Your dad died.
While I was in the hospital.
While you were in the hospital, and your mom had a stroke. So in many ways, you were living what often happens in midlife.
Yes, and if I can just tell you kind of how I got into actually researching this book. You're right, my dad had died, and then my mom had a stroke. And my mother is a wonderful person. She's still alive. She did fine. But she was 89 years old at the time. And mom's singular gift is her insight, her ability to kind of work through problems. Problems with me and articulate really good answers. So the idea that my mom would never speak again, that she might never become conscious again, was just really, really, it was horrible. It was really tragic for me. And so I remember coming home. I'd been at the ICU several days, and mom still hadn't spoken. Mm. And I came home, and it was this beautiful day right before Memorial Day, and the you know, leaves were that wonderful shade of green, and you know, the neighbors were trotting by with their dogs, and everything was happy, and I felt flat. I felt nothing. I felt like all these small despairs were accumulating. And I looked at my husband. We were cooking dinner, and he was slicing a tomato, I'll remember. And I looked at him, and I said, Devin, you know what? I think I'm having a midlife crisis. Yeah. And he put down the tomato, and he said, don't do that. Please don't have a midlife crisis. And so that started it. The next day, I got up and started the research.
Well, you say, and I said in my introduction, that there's no evidence of a midlife crisis. Not to say that people don't at this period of life sense right. that things are changing.
Right.
Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the not better.
Right.
But this idea of a crisis.
It's really very rare. Now, some people do have it. About 10% of people do have this kind of existential dread of dying without achieving their dreams, that kind of thing. But when it started back in 1965, when the whole idea was coined, it was with a very small sample of men. And then Gail Sheehy came along and she published Passages, and then it became, you know, a phenomenon. Everyone has to get a red sports car and everyone has to dump their wife and, you know, all of that stuff. And then psychologists said, you know what, let's see how actually common this is. And only about 10% of people said they actually have this existential angst, which is not to say, as you mentioned in the intro, this is a complicated time.
Yes.
It's not giddy with happiness. People do actually have a dip in happiness in their 40s and 50s, but it's not a crisis.
Well, you and I are sort of the same age. I think I'm a little bit older. I would say from myself is that I am very aware of my mortality.
Yes.
And I'm not obsessed about it. I'm not scared of death. I'm not dying that I'm aware of. But I sense, and I've lost my parents, I've lost friends, I've lost neighbors. I sense the shortness of life.
Yes, and that can be a scary thing, or it actually can infuse your life with meaning. So what researchers have found at Stanford and other places is that when people begin to see the end, see that they are not, it's not the end tomorrow, but the end is, you know, we don't have an infinite amount of time left here. They begin to focus on things that are really important to them. And almost inevitably, what that means is other people who you are close to, or causes that you think are important. And it can be church, it can be a political cause, whatever it is. But what seems to fall away more and more is this kind of ambition to climb the ladder, to, you know, to be Marty, to be you right at the top of the game. I mean, you have this, it's wonderful, but people begin to shift and really focus on other things that have meaning long term.
If there's a theme that runs through this, it's about in midlife doing things new. I mean, it is easy to have traditions and have rituals and to sort of live your life the way you always have, but that new, that the brain likes newness.
Yes, the brain likes it. One of the major themes I came across after all of these interviews was this idea, autopilot is death.
Yeah.
Now, my editor thought that was a little dreary, so we turned it into engage with verve, right? That's a little more cheerful. But the fact is that if you start taking things for granted, if you go on autopilot in your work or in your marriage or take your kids for granted or your health for granted, that is really a recipe for a midlife funk. But if you really engage, if you focus on new things, I mean, the brain, as you mentioned, the brain loves novelty. Marriage, the brain loves novelty in marriage too. I mean, my husband and I went on an RV trip,
yes,
right?
Yes, you did.
So, which we can talk about. But at any rate, the brain really loves novelty. And the more you can challenge it, the better you're going to be. And I don't mean necessarily brain training games where you sit in front of a computer. Just, you know, maybe you learn the guitar. Mm-hmm. Maybe you pick up French. Whatever it is, if you can challenge your brain, you're going to be much happier.
What did you do?
Well, what I did.
You've done a bunch of things.
Yes, I've done a bunch of things. Okay, so I am really terrible at languages, so that was out for me. And I'm not very musical, so that was out for me. Actually, you know, what's interesting about the research is often you go back to those things that you liked or wanted to do as a child. So for me, what I did is I was fairly athletic, and so I began to cycle. I got dared into it, and I began to cycle. And that doesn't sound very intellectual, but the research shows that there's almost nothing you can do that's better for your brain than exercising.
Wow.
Even mild exercise, you know, 3 times a week where you get your heart up, it's been shown to actually turn back kind of the memory clock by up to 2 years. And so I started cycling, and I feel great physically and mentally.
Well, you had a little accident. You did break your collarbone.
Yes.
So these things happen in life, and certainly when in an active life.
Right, right. Yes,
going to happen.
I got dared. I was profiling someone who was competing in the National Senior Games for people 50 and older. And he, after our interview, he challenged me to go on a bike ride with him. So we went on this 20-mile bike ride, me on my old clunker and him on his sleek, you know, thoroughbred of a bike. And I was so tired when I got done with that bike ride. And he said, okay, now what we're going to do is we're going to get you qualified for the senior games.
Oh.
And so, okay, so he puts his challenge in front of me, and I pretend I'm unhappy about it, but secretly I'm really happy about it because it's a challenge. Well, I get a new bike at Mike's urging, and the third day, I hit a pothole and go flying through the air and break my collarbone. But in the process of that, Marty, I was actually studying resilience research at the time. And so I tried to use some of those ideas of resilience research to actually get me through this period where literally, I mean, you break a collarbone, you can't drive, and I had interviews to do. I was traveling. I had to rent a car. Can't do that. Can't even wash your hair. Can't type. I mean, this really set me back for a while. How do you get through that? And I kind of thought about the principles of you know, resilience.
Well, you had some pain, and you've had to deal with other pains in your life, and often people do, and I think as you get older, the risk of having chronic pain can be a reality.
Right.
That can define someone's life, and if we're talking about middle age, certainly define someone's life.
You know, it's really shocking how common chronic pain is. I had always been really, really healthy, very healthy, until right before my first book was published, and I lost my voice for a month,
and that's inconvenient. Hard for a radio
person. That's really hard for a radio reporter. I got it back, but for the next few years, it was next three years or so, it was a temperamental voice. I'd lose it for days or weeks at a time. And then the chronic pain set in the spring of 2012. Now, it wasn't surprising because my brother has the very same thing. Oh. It turned out I had a partially paralyzed vocal cord, which was, you know, bad, but not terrible until the chronic pain began. And, you know, someone told me something, one of these career researchers told me something that was really interesting. He said, you know, Barb, if you're in a job that's a little bit off for you, one of two things will happen. Either you will leave the job or your body will make you leave the job. Now, I love NPR, but, you know, Deadline News does not play to my strengths. And I'd been doing it for 30 years and, you know, nearly 20 at NPR, but before that, the Christian Science Monitor. And it was, I think it really built up, the stress really built up in me. Huh. Well, as much as I loved NPR, the deadlines were hard on me. And so what happened is my body made me leave. And I ended up getting a book contract and leaving.
Here you are. And here you are. I do want to talk about some of this really interesting science and about forgetting and brain imaging, all of which you did. But I just want to make sure that we spend a little time talking about the effect of the, as it's called, the Great Recession of 2008. I mean, it affected everyone in this country. But since we're talking about people in middle age,
right,
it had a particular kind of effect on people that were – they weren't ready to retire. But they had been doing whatever they were doing probably for quite a bit of their life.
Right, right. Some of the problem with the midlife research is that there's a time lag. And so, you know, it takes a while to get people out in the field and then get it published in a peer-reviewed journal and all of that. They haven't really captured – maybe they're beginning to capture the midlife – I mean the crisis of 2008. I did capture it because we sent out a call out on NPR's Facebook page saying, how's midlife treating you? We got about 700 emails within a couple of hours.
Wow.
The biggest trigger for crisis – I won't say crisis, but deep unhappiness – was losing their jobs. And what you find is that kind of – it's a little bit bleak, but kind of 55 is the new 65. It's really hard to get back to where you were when you were in your 50s. Having said that, I kept in touch with many, many people, and almost all of them got back into their careers and were happy. But it was hard, and often they took a career – you know, they took a pay cut. It's a difficult time. They stuck to it, though, and they – almost everyone I talked to got back in the game.
Which says several things. One is that in many ways people can be resilient. They can recover. I mean, maybe it's not the plan that they had at that point in their life, but they were able to reconfigure it.
They were. And I mean, and they always kept their eye on the ball. So there was an urban planner that I talked to who lost his job and applied for 1,000 jobs and was driving a bus and wasn't doing exactly what he wanted to do. And he slowly worked his way back to where he wanted to, you know, volunteering and doing other things. And then he got back into his profession, into the area of expertise. And so you see that it's hard, it's circuitous, but people just, they keep pushing. And with midlife, you're young enough to keep pushing. And so they did.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Barbara Bradley Haggerty is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. If that voice is familiar, it's because for 19 years, she was a reporter for NPR. She's got a new book. It's called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife, talking about what midlife offers all of us. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. Barbara will be talking about having her brain looked at. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you're just joining us, our guest is Barbara Bradley Haggerty, and we're talking about her new book, Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. As we all know, that word midlife is often associated with the word crisis, that we're more likely to dread entering this phase of life rather than relishing it. She uses information about neurology, genetics, sociology, as well as her own story to reimagine the possibilities, purposes, and pleasures of middle age. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You write about the fact that you had memory problems. I think everyone feels at a certain age like, I can't remember anything. Did you think your memory problems were unique or just part of
The normal aging process. Well, I didn't quite know. My dad had dementia, so that was a little bit scary, but he didn't have Alzheimer's, so that was a comfort. I don't know. You know, when you walk around frantically looking for your cell phone and then you realize you're talking on it, I mean, that gives you a little bit of pause.
Yeah.
You know, where did I put my keys? All of that stuff. I think for you and for me and for probably anyone who's listening, memory is a huge issue. We value our brain. And so this was a very scary thing. I think it's a night terror of every baby boomer I know. Mm. And so what I did is when I started the brain research, I was a little bit worried, right? But what I found out was really, really great. And that is that midlife is kind of a peak of cognitive abilities. And the reason is that there are really two types of intelligence that scientists look at. They look at fluid intelligence. Now, that's the bad news. First for the bad news.
Okay.
Fluid intelligence drops basically after age 30. So your processing speed slows. You feel it. Your ability to solve novel problems quickly, you know, Sherlock Holmes, right? That just goes down from around age 30 on. But there's something called crystallized intelligence, and that is like all the stuff you scoop up in a lifetime. It's your expertise. It's your what you learned in the New York Times today. It's your wisdom. It's your ability to navigate the workplace, right? All that stuff just increases right into your 70s.
Wow.
And so what happens at midlife is you haven't lost that much fluid intelligence, but you've gained a whole lot of expertise and wisdom. And so you are operating at your peak. And it's why, like, for example, why you would rather have a 50-year-old surgeon than a 30-year-old surgeon. Even though the 30-year-old might be faster and more nimble, the 50-year-old has seen it before. And when things go wrong, you want that 50-year-old because he or she knows exactly what to do.
I mean, is that wisdom? Is that what we're talking about?
It's wisdom and expertise. And that really does not begin to decline until like your 80s.
But you do write, people, I mean, as you get older, your brain does shrink.
Yes,
so
your
it's not
shrinks.
Like at the same size it was when you're 21.
No, it doesn't. But fortunately, we compensate. We're really good at compensating. And so, you know, what's kind of what brain researchers say is it's really given all that's going on physiologically in the brain and firing more slowly and shrinking and all that, it's really kind of amazing that we operate as well as we do, but we compensate.
You know, I have to say my smartphone has become one of my best friends. And then when this happens, we'll go out to dinner with friends and we're talking about something and someone will say, "What is the capital of Iowa?" And then, everyone reaches their cell phone and Googles that.
I know.
It is a help, I think.
It is a help. I'm not sure it's fundamentally a great thing for our brains, right? I mean, I used to be able to remember phone numbers. And now, you know, the phone number I call all the time, what is it? Oh, I'll just hit the contact, right? So that's a problem.
There's a picture of you all hooked up having your brain looked at. So what were you looking for and what did you find?
So what we were doing, I did this kind of horrifying test. You see, I don't like standardized tests. And so but I read about all of this research on increasing your fluid intelligence, that part of your IQ that's supposed to kind of be genetic and not be able to be increased. And so I went to the University of Maryland, where two researchers were really debunking a lot of the myths about that. And they gave me a battery of cognitive tests that tested my working memory and my fluid intelligence, you know, solving novel problems. It was a nightmare.
Yeah, it sounded horrible.
It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. I mean, I almost left in tears, but I didn't. And then they gave me this brain training game that I played for 22 sessions over the next month. And basically the idea was to increase my working memory, my ability to juggle things in my mind. And it's a complicated game and I won't get into it, but basically this was a nightmare as well. I mean, it was a little thing I dreaded every day because it was really, really hard. I got better at it and better at it. But then I go back for the test a month after the first time I took them. It felt as if time slowed down when I was taking the second set of cognitive tests. It felt as if I had more time to think about the answers. I finished far more answers than I did the first time. And in terms of the gold standard of fluid intelligence, I increased by 75%.
Wow.
Now,
unusual?
Yes. They were like,
star
whoa.
Pupil here?
Yes. They were like, wow, that's pretty great. Now, maybe I had a bad day the first time and a good day the second time. Maybe I just felt more confident. There was some kind of retest effect, so I was a little more familiar with these tests. But they thought that this was not a placebo. They thought that actually my working memory had improved. The good news is, so you don't have to sit in front of a computer to do this. In fact, researchers say that's probably not a great idea. You're better off getting out, getting some exercise, you know, getting blood to your brain, right? Or you're better off doing something novel, you know, learning the guitar or learning Spanish or going to the museum or anything that really challenges your brain. You're better off doing that than sitting in front of a computer. But that's what I did.
But it's also practice. I mean, this is something that you worked on for about a month in order to improve your performance.
Right. I did. But that's true of like Spanish, too. Right? You practice it every day. You improve your performance. You get more and more confident. And the good thing about things like Spanish, for example, I did profile someone who learned Spanish in her 50s. She actually, it not only helped her brain, but it increased her network of friends. And she began to travel through South America on her own. She had new experiences. She made new friends in her hometown and also abroad. And so we know that friendships and networks of friends are really good for your memory too and your health. And so the thing about hobbies is it helps you in lots of different ways, not just in the immediate way of, you know, I'm going to cycle and that'll help my brain and my body. But I have all these friends I cycle with now, and that increases my network of friends.
Well, let's talk about friends. And then I do want to get some callers in on the conversation, because you do look at relationships, attachment. I mean, what that means in middle age.
Right.
What did you find?
well, it's not great news because of the way we behave. The way we behave is this. When we get married and begin to have kids and have a career, the first thing to go is friends. But that's actually a really, really bad idea, because friends actually are you can offload your stress onto your friends. So I have a really good friend named
Joe. Do they like that?
Yeah. Well, they do it to you.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's a shared experience, right?
If someone else's stress doesn't feel quite as stressful.
That's
right.
True. So I have a good friend named Jody Hassett, and you know, we talk about the news business all the time because she was with ABC News. And we navigate, okay, how do I handle this? What do I do? How would you approach this story? Da, da, da. I'm offloading my stress to her. And actually what they find is that having friends, having a network of friends, boosts your immune system, it repairs skin, and, you know, helps your blood vessels and your tissues. You live longer, you recover faster from cancer, actually, and you even preserve your memories better. So having friends are really, really important. It's just too bad they're the first things to go. If it's possible to maintain them, you really should try to do that.
What about friends on Skype? I mean, is there something about the physical sort of tactile relationship we have with friends that are – we meet for lunch, for instance?
Right. That's important. So the big difference between, say, millennials who use the internet and Facebook and all of that – if they use Facebook. I'm not sure. Do they use Facebook? I don't think so.
Kind of old-fashioned.
Okay, yeah, right. Okay, whatever they use. They use it not as a substitute for friends, but as a way to meet up with friends, right? Or talk to friends or things like that. That is great. The danger is when people use the internet as a substitute for real human contact and relationship. So that actually can create a real problem. If you're an extreme introvert and you just use Facebook for that reason, that's going to be a problem.
Let me ask you one more thing, because you also did an experiment, actually had your brain scanned while you were holding hands with your friend, Sherry.
Right, Sherry, right. That's right. Yes, I went down to the University of Virginia, where Jim Cohn is doing this experiment. And basically, here's what it is. They put this anklet on you, and it is supposed to give you an electric shock, which, by the way, really, really hurts. Yeah, it really, really hurts. At least it hurt me. And then they put me in a brain scanner, and I could see on the screen above me either an X, which meant I had a 20% chance of getting that horrible shock, or a zero, where I had no chance of getting it. And they tried it in three conditions: when I was alone, when I was holding a stranger's hand, one of the technicians, and when I was holding Cherie's hand. Now, what happened when I saw that I might be shocked, when I saw that X, when I was holding no one's hand or the stranger's hand, the fear centers of my brain lit up like a Christmas tree, right? It's like I'm thinking, run, 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 okay? When I'm holding Cherie's hand, the whole brain was quiet. Wow. It was as if there wasn't even a threat to deal with, because I was offloading some of the problem to her. It was like, okay, we're facing it together. And my brain responded to that.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Barbara Bradley Haggerty, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about what she learned writing her new book. It's called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from John, he says, could Barbara comment on starting a family after 50? And people do all, you know, families are reconfigured and so many, reimagined in so many different ways as well.
Wow, that is a really, you know, that I've never gotten that question before. I mean, I kind of started a family a little bit when I was 43, because that's when I got married. So that's not exactly the same thing. But, you know, when you have these blended families, what the research shows is one of the things you really need for a good long-term marriage is adaptability, because we all change. Things change. If you're in a marriage where the two of you are facing these problems together, okay, we have a blended family. This is hard. Okay, you know, I'm 55 and I don't feel like getting up in the middle of the night to feed the baby or whatever it might be. That's hard. But if you can be adaptable and approach it as a team, you're going to get through. It's interesting, Marty, because there hasn't been much research on long-term marriages, but there's been a little bit where they've followed marriages over 20 years, mm-hmm. the same people mm-hmm. over 20 years. And what they've found is that one of the keys to being happy and not divorced at the end of 20 years is if you approach life as a team. And they actually said if you use we and us, those pronouns as opposed to I and me, that was an indicator that you were approaching life as a team and you were going to get through things a lot better. So what I would say is if you're starting a family at 50 years old, good on you and be adaptable and face it as a team.
And say the word we. let me get Rick from Warminster to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. One of the things I found over the years is look at your life as chapters. I had 25 years in the service, and I think the daily routine of being with 18 to 25-year-old soldiers keeps you young. You get into their world. You mentor them. Then when I went into the corporate world for the next 16 years, I consciously mentored college students finishing up their last year. I had 32 interns over 16 years.
Wow.
And I said, I'll teach you the wisdom of the workplace. You teach me the currency of the classroom. So I think by staying with young people, mentoring, you go back, you see your life with some achievement, some adventure. You share that with them, and you're giving back. And I found that that was very adventuresome.
That's great.
And very rewarding.
Well, Rick, I appreciate the call. I should add, you're 73 years old.
Oh,
so just to add to the conversation, let me give Barbara a chance to respond.
You've done exactly what the research says you should do. Eric Erickson, who's a great psychologist or who was a great psychologist, talks about this concept of generativity, that's the hallmark of a healthy midlife. And by generativity, he means investing outward into the next generation, or it also can mean into a cause. But basically, it's no longer about accumulation. Gee, I want a bigger house. I want a bigger job. I want more cars, that kind of thing. It's more about investing outward and giving your wisdom outward. And he has done precisely that. It is actually the recipe for a really healthy and happy and young older age.
That's great. Rick, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. What he said also about chapters reminded me of something that you write about, the Boston College Sports Leadership Center, Life Without Punctuation, the idea of the importance of milestones, and having punctuation.
You know, that was a metaphor that helped me more than any other metaphor I heard. There's a woman named Kathy Utschneider at Boston College, and she trains elite middle-aged athletes. A lot of them had never been athletic before they started training. But what she talked about was when we are young, so you're a young adult, you have a lot of milestones, right? You have a lot of markers. You graduate from college, you get married, you begin to have kids, you launch your career. You know, all of this happens, and then you hit midlife. And it goes on and on and on, and there are not a lot of markers.
Yeah.
And she described it like a book without punctuation. It's a lot of words without paragraphs, without commas or periods or semicolons. What you should do is actually create that punctuation. And this is where, you know, one of the secrets, I think, to people who are really happy at midlife is that they resurrect an old hobby or they start a new passion. So I talked to a woman who used to be a really great flutist when she was in her teenage years. She dropped it for 30 years. When her kids started taking lessons, she picked it up again. It was hers again. And she felt like she was young again. She had recaptured some of her youth. I did it with biking. I felt young. I felt young. I'd go out there and I'd have like a goal. Okay, I'm going to do 50 miles today, or I'm going to do these intervals today. I'm going to try to qualify for the senior games. And I felt young. I had punctuation.
Interesting. interesting. And even just, Rick, I mean, smartly, I think the idea of mentoring young people. And we do live in so many ways in kind of age-segregated worlds where, you know, if you're 70 years old or 73 years old, as Rick described, your contact with someone who's 27 years old is going to be minimal.
You know, and the thing is, I think people feel and you can do something about that. I mean, Rick has. I am very conscious of working with young people, you know, hiring them as researchers or mentoring them or whatever. I'm very conscious of that. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is, you know, you think as an older person that they don't really want to bother with you. You know, you're wearing glasses and you're old and you've got wrinkles and stuff like that. Actually, they do, because you've got a lot of wisdom. You can help them think through problems. You can give them the long-term perspective. This is not the end of the world if such and such happened. You can just say, okay, you know what? How do we deal with this? Oh, great. Okay, just do this avenue. Go down this road. They want that kind of wisdom that only years gives you. So it's a win-win. They want you and you want them, so do it.
We're almost about a break here. I mean, are you a different person as a result of writing this book and the research that went into it?
I am so much happier.
Are you?
Oh, my gosh. I am so much happier. I was a little bit depressed when I started. I mean, not clinical depression or anything, but when I began reading the research and realized how much there was, how wonderful midlife could be and what opportunities there were, I flourished.
Hmm. And the idea of saying, I'm going to do this, I'm going to try that.
Yes. It's hard.
It is hard.
It is hard. You have to get out of your routines. It's not easy. And routines are really nice and comfortable. But you know what? They're kind of the recipe for funk. You know, you really need to get out of them.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking with Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She wrote a book a couple of years ago, Fingerprints of God, her second book called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife, exactly what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Any questions or comments or stories, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Barbara Bradley Haggerty about midlife, about reimagining midlife, her new book called Life Reimagined. Email from Michael. He says, in 2011, my wife Larissa and I had just turned 50, so we quit our job, sold our house, gave away our possessions to travel the world for what we thought would be a year. 5 years later, we're still on the road as global nomads and now write the weekly field-tested travel tips column in the Philadelphia Inquirer travel section. I know who these people are. Continued travel and new friendships have really helped to keep us young and our minds sharp. So basically, at 50, they said, we're traveling the world.
Oh, my goodness. Good on them. You know, actually, when I was doing the research for this book, because my husband and I went on a little RV trip,
yes,
right?
Yes, you did.
Yes. And I was trying to – I'd never done this before, and I ended up being in touch with a couple of people who did the very same thing, except in an RV. And it turns out there's this, like, whole underground community of people who – In their late 40s or their 50s, they decided, you know, we can do what we need to do out of an RV in this case. We can sell the jewelry. I can make jewelry. We can do the newsletters, blah, blah, blah. And we are going to have a lot of fun. And there's a whole group of people who do this. They are so brave. I wish I could do it.
Well, you had, as you described, the best vacation ever on your little RV adventure trip.
Right, right. So when my husband and I went on our first date, he told me how much he wanted to travel the country in an RV. Now, I thought, but did not say, because it was our first date and he was pretty cute, I did not say that's the most boring or pointless thing I can think of doing. But
stifling yourself.
But we ended up, when I read the research about novelty and how important that is in marriage, I went to him and I said, okay, let's rent an RV. And I've got to tell you, everything, we did it with two friends. It was two lawyers, a PhD, an NPR reporter, and our dog. And we did it with two friends.
Sandra Day,
that's
your
right.
Dog.
We wanted a smart blonde, but Hillary was too divisive. So we went with Sandra Day. So at any rate, the five of us go riding around in this RV. It rained. It poured every single day. It was like the rainiest June on record, that kind of thing. we got caught in floods. The brakes almost went out. There was a disaster every single day. And we had the time of our lives because it was completely out of our comfort zone. You know, I didn't know how to dump
black
water.
Did you have the time
of
your lives while you were doing it?
We did. And we still talk about it. Maybe it's a little better in retrospect. But no, we still talk. And we want to do it again. It was a blast because it was all so new and different. Right. And we actually saw different – I saw different aspects of my husband that I hadn't seen before that I could admire. Like he's really good at navigating a map. Right?
Or changing a tire.
Well, no, we won't go
not
that
so much.
Far. But he's good with maps.
Let me get Art from King of Prussia to join us. Hi, Art. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And you've been talking about me for 45
Yes, we have.
I'm 79 years old, and I've stopped doing the New York Times crossword puzzle because it's puzzles within puzzles that I can't handle.
Yep.
However, I am learning to speak Italian, and I'm not of Italian heritage.
How's it going?
How's
it going?
Difficult because we have one word, the. The Italians have 8 words, depending on person and in the conjugation of verbs, it goes crazy.
Sure.
But anyway, that's due to my oldest grandson, or our oldest grandson. Mm-hmm. I usually use our or we instead of me and so on. when he was in high school, between his junior and senior year, he took a short course at a community college in Italian. He has had 3 Italian grandparents, and then there's me. But anyway, I thought to myself, who's he going to talk to? No one speaks Italian. And on our 50th wedding anniversary, my wife is the Italian, and that was in 2010, we went to Italy. And guess who was able to communicate with the
terrific.
Natives?
Wow. Art from King of Prussia.
Huh?
Art from King of Prussia. No, it's a terrific call, and I appreciate it. And I know Barbara wants to respond as well.
No, that you've done everything right. And don't you feel really great about being able to talk to people in Italian? I mean, you
exactly.
don't have to wait for your wife to translate. I mean, it's a real victory. When I listen to your story, there are so many things that are good. One is this kind of generativity, the investment in your grandson. Who else is he going to talk to? That's just a wonderful idea. This idea of we, that you and your wife were in this together, that you've actually done something that can actually bring you closer, right? That's very cool. And then the travel, the novelty. I mean, everything about this story is good.
Thanks for calling in, Art. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Interestingly, he says, you know, he's given up on the New York Times crossword puzzle. You do say, yes, it's important to do new things, but things that are challenging.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, one thing that researchers say is if you're already good at the New York Times, at the crossword puzzle, you don't do that anymore. Right. I mean, it's fun to do it, but don't make that your mainstay of, you know, strengthening your brain. Do something different. If you're already good at something, try something that's different so that you will create new connections, you know, in your brain. You want to get out of procedural memory where everything's by rote. And I don't like crossword puzzles either, so I don't blame them for quitting.
Fair enough. You went to a laughing clinic. Why did you do that?
That was really for my resilience research. At this point, I was having chronic pain in my vocal cords, and I'd really read that how you think and how you approach life, your thinking is your experience. My mom would always say that. And when I got chronic pain, I realized that there was a lot of research suggesting that how you think about the pain affects how bad the pain is. That if there's an emotional component to it, it's worse. So if you know you're going to get a migraine, there's an emotion to it that actually makes the migraine worse. So I went to this the Cancer Treatment Centers of America and watched a laughter clinic, and it was unbelievable what I saw. It was like watching people rise from the dead, and I'm not kidding, because there are people on IVs and, you know, in wheelchairs and all of that. And they started kind of this laughter clinic where she'd get them to – the person who was leading it would get them to kind of laugh, ho, 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 ha,
like
ha,
kind
ha,
of fake
ha.
Laugh.
Right, fake laugh. But it turned into real laughter. And by the end of the time, people were hysterically laughing. I interviewed a bunch of them. No pain. Now, that won't stay that long, but what it said is that they had distracted themselves, and we know that distraction is really important for pain, but they had distracted themselves with laughter and joy, and the pain levels just decreased. They really dropped to almost nothing.
But what's so interesting, what started as fake laughing became real laughing.
Yeah.
I mean, there was something contagious
about
it.
Yes, there is. There is something very contagious about it. And when I watched that, I thought, maybe I can do something about, maybe I can change my pain level by the way I think about things.
And did you try the laughing stuff?
I didn't try the laughing stuff.
Just looked too silly?
It was a little too silly, and also I didn't know of another clinic nearby. But what I did do is I used kind of the principles of neuroplasticity to calm my vocal cords. And it's a little bit of meditation. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of distraction, doing something positive. And what I found is that when I practice this, every time I had pain, I had a little ritual I went through. And I found that I went from a lot of pills to kind of calm down my vocal cords because they were always firing, from a lot of them, and I won't say quite how many, but to three.
Wow.
So I'm basically off of medicine, almost off of medicine. I'm just a little scared to wean myself completely, but I basically don't need it.
Let me see what Bill from, looks like Center City, Philadelphia, has to say. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I really enjoyed the prior caller.
Thanks.
I suggest one thing aged people can do, or aging careers can do, is still involve themselves in civic activation protest. But anyway, for the physically capable, even RV can be a difficult task, right? Going on a trip.
Sure.
But music is different, right? It affects the brain differently. And I go dancing. I go over to XPN Free at Noon. I go, you know, I go dancing with anybody who'll dance. I dance by myself. But even if you can't dance, music is different. It connects differently to the brain. So I wonder if your research did
anything on
music.
Sure, that's interesting, Bill. Appreciate the call.
That's great. I actually looked very briefly at that because the brain research suggests the, you know, and the memory research researchers find that music and dance is actually one of the best things you can possibly do for your brain. And I don't know why. I didn't investigate why dance or music is so great for your memory, but it really, really does stave off. It delays the onset of dementia. So what he's doing is absolutely terrific.
Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I mean, music is so interesting because you can hear a song that you haven't heard since you were 15 years old.
Right.
There are the words. There's the tune.
Yeah.
It's right there.
You can't remember, you know, you can't remember what you had for breakfast this morning, but you sure remember where you were when you heard that song.
Exactly. Here's an email from Molly. She says, I think one assumption that's made when midlife reinvention is discussed is that there's a certain amount of financial independence or that there's a partner involved. But what if you're a single person who's likely always to have to work? And that's such an important question.
It is a really important question. It's actually the hardest question that I've dealt with. I think that midlife crisis or midlife reinvention is kind of a privileged phenomenon. A lot of people, especially people who are single or working moms or working dads or whatever single, they can't afford to just reinvent themselves. But here's what they can do, and I've talked to a lot of people who did do this. They have looked at what their skills are, what they're good at, what they love, and managed to find an outlet for those. It may be at work. It may be pivoting on your work and doing something a little bit different. Maybe you're mentoring younger people or something like that. You go from being a management in news business back to being an editor because you really like to be an editor. Maybe it's in the organization, but maybe it's something outside of the organization. Maybe you're committed to a cause or to your church or synagogue or something like that. There is a way to bring meaning into your life, and really the cure for midlife crisis is meaning. The cure for blues is finding meaning in your life. And so while it is difficult and one is more circumscribed if one doesn't have the financial ability to reinvent themselves, you still can find ways, outlets for meaning.
Let me see what Eric from Bucks County has to say. Hi, Eric. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I'm 65. I don't know if that qualifies me as being
yes,
you can. We'll take all calls. Go ahead,
anyway,
Eric.
My son was in Spain, and he did the Camino de Santiago about 3 years ago.
The pilgrimage.
Convinced me to do it. It's a 500-mile pilgrimage. And I did it twice in the last 2 years, and being 65. And the point of being that we can change our attitudes about our own lives at any time. And I was in a square having dinner one day in Astorga. All of a sudden I realized, I look at my journal, and I'm writing down my journal, all my thoughts. I've been happy for the last 17 days straight at that point. And that's a rare thing. I can't remember when I ever thought to myself, I've been happy every single day for the last 17 days. And I also realized at that point that we weren't meant to spend the rest of our lives in doubt and misery. And you can be 65, and you can change your idea fundamentally about your place in the world.
Well, Eric, that's a terrific call. And I can't tell you how many times in the last couple of months I've heard about the way. I have some neighbors who are doing this as well. It's a pilgrimage. It's in Spain. I think you said, Eric, it's what, 500? You walk 500 miles?
Yes.
It's impressive.
Wow, that's really, really impressive. I mean, this is a theme. I saw a couple of themes in all of my research. One of them is this idea that you just touched on, your thinking is your experience, how you approach life. It really, really does. It won't change the cancer diagnosis, okay? Right. But it will help frame it, and it will help you find meaning in this whole terrible journey, but also relying on other people. It'll increase your relation. You know, you can find meaning and happiness even when you have a bad diagnosis. And the other couple things that I saw was this notion of choosing purpose over happiness, over short-term happiness. And it's this idea, and I think all of our callers have done this, really. You know, hedonism, which gets a bad rap. I mean, everyone likes a good meal and, you know, all of that, and to see a movie and all of that. But hedonism actually, hedonistic happiness is actually not that great for the brain or the body. Well, let me tell you what is good.
Sure.
Eudaimonia. That is this long-term striving. It's what Aristotle talked about. It's investing in something that may not make you very happy right in the moment, like raising good kids, right? You may not be that happy when you're getting up in the middle of the night when your child is sick, or you may not be happy when you're disciplining your child, but that is an investment in the future, and over the long term, it's going to create happiness and purpose. Training for a marathon, it hurts when you're doing it.
Sure.
But you know what? It's really good in the long term. So this idea that you shouldn't just look at your immediate surroundings and say, am I happy? You need to kind of, what would be good to do is to invest longer terms, in especially in midlife, in things that will outlive you, like your children, like a cause. It'll outlive you. It'll be your legacy.
Let me ask you one more thing, and this is about a psychiatrist you went to, Srini, is it Pillay?
Pillay, yes.
Went to this psychiatrist for some guidance.
Right. Well, so actually what happened is I was, he was giving a coaching class. He was teaching all these people about how to do change in midlife, right? And he teaches both at the Harvard Business School and at the medical school. So he kind of combines neuroscience with business. So he was training all of these people about how do you approach change, especially if you want to change your job and that kind of thing. And I was following it. I was there. I was recording it and all that. And after the morning session, he had said a few things that I wanted clarification on. And so I went up to him and I said, can I just talk to you about this? And he said, sure, but let's just try an experiment. And he started asking me these very psychiatrist-like questions. And he started to ask me about, you know, what am I thinking about a change? And at this point, I had not yet accepted the buyout. I didn't know there would be a buyout for NPR, but I did know that I had problems with my vocal cords that were exacerbated by the stress. And I said, well, you know, I'm kind of thinking about change. And he said, well, what's keeping you from it? And he went through this whole thing. What is it? Is it, well, I'm a little worried about who am I if I'm not an NPR reporter? And he kind of walked me through what are my fears. And at the end of the line, I realized that my fears were, I needed to conquer my fears because I had to get over that hurdle to make this larger step.
We're going to end on that note. Thank you so much, Barbara Bradley Haggerty, for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Margaret.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. You can download podcasts, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.